This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So, welcome to the Saturday of the global warming. So, it's many of us, probably all of us, who have encountered another human being today have had stories to tell about what exactly that means. And so I've been thinking about it, as you know, we Buddhist types think about everything. And it's interesting to me that, you know, between Katrina and Harvey, between the years of drought and the too much rain this winter, thinking about what's going on with our friends who live and swim in the oceans and the waterways, everything from salmon to the what are those things that live down on the pier that are not doing well because of the dirt in the water. And so it seems to me like the impact of man's lifestyle choices on the ecology just can't be questioned, right? And yet, there's an actual definition for something called a climate denier, right? There's a group of people who call themselves that, and it makes no sense to me whatsoever. And, you know, as I thought about them and read some of their stuff over the last couple weeks, you know, I was thinking that perhaps they have their meetings in the offices of something called the Flat Earth Society. You may find that amusing, but that group actually has existed for more than 100 years, have offices in various places, and I went on their website because I couldn't believe it. One of their teachings is that the idea of a global work is the work of Satan. That Satan has gotten into somebody's head and made you think, on all of some of our heads, I won't speak for you, that the world is not flat, and that the current president gave a talk in which he said he knows it's flat because when he rides his bicycle, he doesn't fall over or fly up or whatever. So you know, the question for me is that I'll speak for me for a moment. I have things that I absolutely, when I'm not careful, know to be absolutely true. And I think that includes Buddhist principles, teachings, that includes practices and forms, that includes my professional life, where I actually theoretically get paid to help people see things a different way. And if I'm not careful there, I think I'm getting paid to help them see things my way, not what's going on. But I think for all of us that there's some of that, right? So, we have this idea of the truth, and that there's a truth. And most of us in spiritual life, and some of us in this room are in recovery, we know that there's not just one truth. And so we kind of work with that idea. But, you know, truth is a concept that I think can trip us up, because at the end of the day, you can give me a smile, you don't have to raise your hand, how many of you like to be right? Yeah. Okay, so there's our little challenge, right? So I've been looking at two books in for various reasons, but one is called, it's by Ken Wilber, the philosopher, and it's called Trump and the Post-Truth World. It's actually quite useful, I'll leave it up here if you want to look at it later, but what he says is that he uses examples like the folks who organized Brexit in England, and they, in their report, in their speeches and stuff afterwards, were very clear, and they admitted to using facts which were absolutely not true, and that they knew them not to be true. And in their speeches they said, but it doesn't matter. As long as we believe them to be true, then it's okay. And they said that there really are no facts. And so that in the absence of facts about the economy in that situation, that they were allowed to say anything they pleased. And so it's a kind of a scary proposition that leaders of a country or leaders of an economy would actually say that with seemingly no shame whatsoever. And so Wilbur discusses it, and what he says is that the deciding factor for people such as that is narcissism, right? And probably some of you thought that when I said that. But narcissism basically says, if I want it to be true, it's true. And I'm going to read you just a couple things that he said because they're really quite good. But he describes it as, the truth is whatever I say in the moment. I will change it whenever it suits me. I do not need to be consistent. And it is amazing just how often I convince people I am right by speaking with certainty. And the second one he uses is, I am largely unaware of how my words and actions may impact others. The truth is, I don't actually care. If I get what I want, all else is collateral damage. So there are those people in the world, and at the moment, they're in charge of some things. And so, you know, it strikes me that we as Buddhists have something to offer the world by the way that we show up. I think that one of the things that's clear to me is that we've been thinking about some of this incorrectly, right? We've been talking about whether things are facts or false facts or alternative facts or whatever they are. And I think that for a lot of people, that's really not the point, right? So did the Buddha say this, or did somebody else say it 500 years later, or did somebody interpret it in an upstairs room in Chicago a couple years ago? And so it's like, and we all want to analyze the history and the facts and the data and the evidence. And so one of the things that I believe myself is that people, by and large, who are confused, or who are trying to figure out their place in the world or how the world is changing all around them, sometimes feeling like it's too fast, aren't actually swayed by new data or new evidence. In my generation, and in some of yours, I'm sure, what happened was we were taught things to be true. I went to a Catholic grade school. What they taught was true. You didn't, if you argued with it or debated it, you got a ruler that was on your knuckles or somewhere on your body, and it was their way of dissuading you from debating the truth. When I chose my college that I would go to, I chose one. It was called Monteith College. It was a university without walls. It doesn't exist anymore, but it did in the 60s and 70s. And what they said on their flyers and stuff was, most programs will teach you a set of facts, a set of answers. At Monteith College, you'll learn how to ask questions. And I was particularly attracted to that way of thinking. Because I think what happens is that we learn facts, and that nowadays there's so many media outlets and giant research entities and firms, and we're being bombarded constantly with facts, and then updated facts, and then course corrections, and then the new data. And you know, some of us like to read and debate and think, and that's all good for us. But for a lot of people, it just feels like, damn, I went to all the trouble to learn this, and now you're telling me that it's no longer accurate, that that's no longer right. And it's like, what do I do with that? And, you know, if you're in academia, particularly in any of the sort of more science-oriented fields, then you understand that the data is going to change and that things are going to evolve and that future evidence is going to allow for the theories to be supported or not, and for our view of them to change. And of course, it's been going on since the beginning of recorded time. But I think that there's so much of that, and the virtue of the elections in England and here, people are over it. They don't believe the evidence that they hear. They think it comes from corporate evidence builders and corporate evidence speakers. And so people are really hesitant and weary. And I think when people get in that situation, that what they feel is unmoored, right? So it's like, I don't know what to believe anymore. How many times have you heard somebody say that in the last year? I just don't know what to believe. I know I said it on November 8th or 9th or whatever that day was. Just, I don't know what to believe. How did that happen? And so that continues to happen in our society. And it's my belief that when people are confused, when people are trying to figure out the meaning of their lives and the environment in which they live and how they should engage with other human beings, it's not data and facts that are going to do that. So I don't think it's data and facts that will help people when they're feeling unmoored. I think it's connection. And so I think that words that are meant to nurture and connect, that we speak in our temples and in our study centers and in our courses and in our conversations with each other as Buddhists and with others in society, that what we have the capacity to do is to help people to feel more connected. So the other book that I've been reading is a book called Why Buddhism is True. And it's by Robert Wright. And he's going to be at CIS here in the city on Thursday night talking about his book, and he's going to be in conversation with me. And so I had occasion to speak to him the other day, and the first thing I said was, well, Why Buddhism is True. Interesting title. I assume your second book will be called Why Buddhism is Not True, and that your third one might be called Why Buddhism is Both True and False, and your fourth book could be Why Buddhism is Neither True or False. And he said, I hadn't thought about that, but there are some books that I could write. So what this book sets out to do is to really help us, and he is himself an evolutionary psychologist, so he wants to know how we used to think and how we think now, and what do we know and how do we know it and how comfortable are we with that. And so he gives us a teaching from the Samajjhara Sutra, which is this: know all things to be like this, a mirage, a cloud, a castle, a dream, an apparition, without essence, but with qualities that can be seen, right? So just two little brief pieces from this. Whichever term you use, the upshot is that in the world out there, which seems to be solid and structural, so full of things with a distinct and tangible identity, there is less than meets the eye. The world of apparent form is in some sense, as the sutra teaches, a mirage, a cloud. Or, as the Heart Sutra famously and pithily puts it, form is emptiness. So we're all feeling very spiritual. That felt good. We're ahead of everybody else. We understand that form is emptiness. And he goes on to say, as you ponder these words, formlessness and emptiness, two other words may come to mind, crazy and depressing. So much for feeling good. It seems crazy that the world out there isn't real, and that things seem substantial are in some sense devoid of content. It also seems kind of depressing. I don't run into a lot of upbeat, fulfilled people who go around rejoicing in the emptiness of it all. So the book is interesting, and you know, I think it's definitely worth taking a look at and reading. It's brings us as Buddhists to engagement with ourselves, with our fellows and in this room and with our communities in a way I think that we can be really useful. You know, we in Buddhism believe that there's not a truth. Just for starters, we believe that there are two truths, right? The apparent or conventional truth and the ultimate truth, right? And so for those who might be newer or who have been baffled by how can there be two truths, the fact is that here I am, and I have arms and legs and feet, some hair and some clothes. Here's a chair. It has legs, and some of them have arms, and it has a seat. And so, yeah, we can see that. That's the truth of the matter. But the fact of the matter is that that's really not two separate things, especially this chair and me at this moment, not two separate things at all. That we are together. And the interesting thing about our language that we use is Stephen has arms and legs. The chair has a seat and a back. And so there's this notion of possession. And I think that's the gift that I've been given by this practice, and hopefully you've been given and will continue to get, is that we don't have possession of anything. Everything has the capacity to arise, everything will abide for a period of time, and everything will depart. Right? So the idea that this is my body, or this, even more troubling, this is my place in the world, or sometimes a good example of that is when we go into a Zendo or a particular 12-step meeting or a particular class or place at work, we all have the place that we sit. And if we're really spiritually evolved, it's okay if someone else is sitting in our seat. But often during the course of the class, they do get a side glance like, you should know that's my chair. What are you doing? I'm spiritually evolved, but not that spiritually evolved. You're sitting in my seat. So I think the way, as soon as we say Stephen has, we're already beginning to think about ownership. And as soon as we notice that we're thinking about ownership, we're doing an interpretation, right? And we know that an interpretation comes from me. And it comes from all of my life experience. It comes from my brain chemistry. It comes from whatever emotional and mental state I'm in this particular day. So, you know, it can be very simple. There's a chair and there's Stephen, and those are two separate things. Those are one thing connected because we're interconnected with all things. And then there's the fact that, you know, it's great if spiritually or emotionally, mentally, you come to the point of saying, ah, Stephen and the chair are the same thing. And then I would say to you, I would appreciate it if you don't sit on me. So again, we have the combination of the two truths, right? So I think that when we think about these two truths in Buddhism, we often use words like boundless or pure or perfect for that ultimate truth. And one of the teachings of the Buddha is that the only way you can get to the ultimate truth is through meditation. And meditation is the process in which we firmly land ourselves in this present moment. So the ultimate truth is the one we find in the present moment. And our moments of enlightenment are the moments that happen in meditation. And so that becomes becomes really truth, really an important truth for all of us. And it allows us to think that there are these two truths, and that there's nothing bad or good about either one of them, that there's nothing right or wrong about either one of them, that in fact they both exist. And with those classifications at all times. And so then when I think about that, I wonder when I started out chatting with you today about the Flat Earth Society, and I clearly had a point of view. I wonder how I work in a society where, and this has become important to me because so many millions of people voted in a way that I don't understand in the last election in this country. And I can't just write all those people off. Some of them are relatives. Some of them are or used to be friends. Some of them are colleagues that I work with and that you all work with. So we can't just write them off. And so as we take a look at our practice as Buddhists and our practice as engaged Buddhists in the world and as human beings, we have to find a new way, it seems to me, of coping with the idea of relative truth, what I see and what I think and what I believe, and the ultimate truth of all things. And so in the Zenzen Ming, that's a poem that many of you are familiar with, the teaching, that sometimes is called a trust in the heart, sometimes it's called trust in the mind, and sometimes it's called verses on faith, among other things. But already the verses, you know, some interpreters they're of the mind, some interpreters are there of the heart. And so a couple of things that are in there I thought were worth sharing with all of us today. And they are, here's the first one, which almost all of us have heard and said it at various times. The great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. So that if we're available for all of the truth, if we are available to not feel like I need to argue or debate or win a discussion, then the great way is not difficult. Another teaching there says, the more you talk and think about it, the farther astray you wander from the truth, right? The more you talk and think about it, the further astray you wander from the truth. And we live in a culture and a time when there's 24/7 news. I think our televisions have 500 channels on them, and they're all talking all day long, all night. And they're all helping us to have opinions and views and be educated and uneducated. And you know, there's all this stuff going on. And our teaching as a Buddhist should allow us not to give up on all that, but to know that, yeah, you know, there's that wonderful teaching about the monk who a family came to him and said, he was living by himself near the lake. And the family came to him and said, "You're a horrible human being. You got our daughter pregnant, and now you're going to take this baby because we're not having it." And he said, "Is that so?" And he takes the baby, and he raises the baby for a little while. And the family comes back and says, "Oh, we are so sorry. You're not a horrible human being. We found out who the father is. It's not you. And so we're going to take our baby back." He said, "Is that so?" And so... so the teaching for me in that story is perhaps that he should join Codependence Anonymous, but past that, the teaching is that people interpret, people come to judgments, and we can engage with their judgments, and get into an argument with them, and go to court, and do all this other stuff, and sometimes in terms of social justice and in terms of personal integrity, that would be a right action. But oftentimes, in my life and in the life of my friends and people I know, the idea of engaging in frantic debate is a sport. It's fun to do, and in some cases that even might be true. A debate society or debate club might be a fun place to go and think about new ideas and learn more and expand our worldview. But I think the trouble comes from the minute that we think I get a win, right? And in capitalist societies, you know, we're geared to think if, you know, somebody's got to win, somebody's got to lose. So if we're having a debate or a discussion about a religious principle or whatever it might be, we need to be very mindful about bringing that practice. And as the teaching says, the more you talk and think about it, the farther astray you get. And so I think it's important to think about those two words. You know, in Buddhism, we occasionally do talk in some of the texts. They actually, frequently you'll hear people say they don't talk about good and bad. Well, they do. And the words for that are puna and bhava, for good and evil. But they don't talk about those much, and we don't talk about them much at all in the American coming of Buddhism. What we talk about is skillful and unskillful. Kusala and akusala, and please pronounce those correctly, not the way I do. And this is Buddhist language that really means skillful and unskillful. Does it work for you? And in the Dhammapada, there's a wonderful teaching about this if you're trying to figure out what it means. And it says, if a man should do evil, he should not do it again. He should not take delight in it. Suffering comes from the accumulation of evil. And if a man should do good, he should do it again and again. He should take delight in it. Happiness stems from the accumulation of meritorious action. So these become important teachings for us. It's like, it's as simple as, if you are operating in an ethical way, and that's a reason that you're here probably, is because we desire to operate in an ethical way. We desire to think about our place in the world, and the mark we leave, and how we take care of each other, and how we take care of our children, and how, as Buddhists, we take care of all sentient beings, you know? It is not okay that they've had to pluck half the salmon population out of the waters in California because there's not enough clean water for them to get upstream in. You know, that's not okay. And it's that the reason for that situation with the salmon is because we put too much stuff in the water. And so we are here because we want to have some ethical standards. And I truly, at various parts of my life, have just wanted someone to come and hand me the tablet with the ethical standards on there. Because I'm good at taking orders. So if you tell me how I'm supposed to behave ethically, I can do that. But I think the wonderful thing about Buddhist practice is it doesn't say that. What it says is that that we will know, that we will come to an understanding, that we will feel and experience the world from our place on the cushion, from this present moment, not based on all the horrible experiences we've had in the past, and not based on our enormous fears about what's going to happen to the salmon population in California, but based on what comes, what with awakening we bring forward in ourselves. I want to share with you a little teaching that Reb gave, and it says, you don't have to work at what you are. Part of what you are is what you think you are, but what you think you are is not all of what you are. Being Buddha means being unattached to your thoughts about what you are. If you think you are a worthy person or an unworthy person, don't grasp at those thoughts. Don't grasp at those thoughts. So I think there's a really powerful teaching in there. And the teaching is that we should learn to be at peace, right? That we should learn to be at peace, to live at peace, and that part of our teaching is that we want to create a world in which others can live at ease and at peace. And so as we think about what's skillful or unskillful, I think we have this opportunity to say, when we're on the cushions doing meditation, it's pretty peaceful. When we're on the cushions not dredging up old history and past wrongs and resentments, and not worrying about what's going to happen 2 days from now when I go to some meeting, when we're doing that, when we're on those on our cushions, we are at peace. We have that opportunity to be at peace. And so I think that we don't have to spend a lot of time debating whether what I think today is true based on my life experience or based on some research. We can read it and experience it and know it and be comfortable with that and then let it go. It too has the power to arise, to abide for a period of time, so long as it's skillful and useful, and then we can let it depart. And so those are, I think, some really powerful things that we can bring to the world, the post-truth world that we're living in. Pablo Neruda, the poet, says in his So Is My Life, he says, my duty moves along with my song. I am not. That is my destiny. I exist not if I do not attend to the pain of those who suffer. They are my pain, for I cannot be without existing for all. So that poem and a lot of his work just really touches my soul, because it's like we are not. Thich Nhat Hanh has taught us all about engaged Buddhism, and most of you have read about that and know about that. And what engaged Buddhism means is that we are responsible, that Buddhism is not some thing that we practice in dark rooms where nobody can see us. Buddhism is what we practice in these beautiful temples, and what we practice when we go outside. He famously taught, and Mio may have been there, but Thich Nhat Hanh gave a talk at Green Gulch Farm, and he said, you people have one of the most beautiful temples I have ever been in. And you have for sure the most beautiful walkway on your property to the ocean and back, to the water and back. He said, and you are the grimmest group of human beings I have ever met. And so his teaching, and for those of you who have had a chance to read his books or experience his teachings, that's what he's talking about. He's talking about this is important, this is vital for us to be down in this beautiful room. And it is vital for us to increase our capacity for a skillful practice of meditation. For us to, you know, to get calm and then to bring awareness. The beautiful, beautiful things that we get to do in this place. And none of it makes any difference if we walk out the door and kick the side of the car that drives in front of us, you know, because they're not, we walked in the street and they wanted to turn and we immediately went nuts. And because most of us know that if we do that, if we tap the car, hit the car, say one of those wonderful things we say to drivers who drive badly, that doesn't just evaporate. That person goes away mad, or stops and shoots us, depending on what neighborhood you're in. And then we go, and that when we've allowed that anger to grow, it doesn't just go away. So then we go home to our partners or friends or into a restaurant And somebody else catches the residual as we hopefully are unwinding that. And so part of what we get to do in these rooms is really to have the opportunity to remember that that we really get to take a good look at this. Shanti Deva said, one law serves to summarize the whole of Mahayana Buddhism. The protection of all beings is accomplished through the examination of one's own mistakes. So one's own mistakes. So we get to look and we get to bring a new thinking, which is, are those behaviors skillful? Are those, when I sit and watch certain kinds of TV shows and I ruminate about you know, what's happening to poor Kim Kardashian this month and how unfairly she's being treated, which I have never done, I'm happy to say. Or not very often anyway. So is that skillful? Is it skillful for me to get into that branch of the media? And not judging for anybody else, but for me, it's absolutely not. Is it skillful for me to watch the news every night and be in some sort of elevated state of fear and panic? For me, it's actually not. But other people can do that, and it's skillful for them. So that's important. But I think it comes down to how we want to engage with each other in Sangha and how we want to engage with each other in community. And I would just close with a sentence that comes from Cahil Gibran, who most of us roll our eyes when we hear that. But he's that wrote the book, The Prophet. But this particular quote comes from The Broken Wings, and he said, and God said, love your enemy. And I obeyed him and began to love myself. Thank you. So I think we have some time for a few questions or comments or corrections. Something more skillful than what I said? Who's feeling rambunctious today? Is it too hot for everybody to feel rambunctious?
Hi, Steve. I particularly appreciate your comments, but your talk today. It's certainly a topic that I've been struggling with, I'm sure pretty much everybody in the room. Mm-hmm. What it comes down to me that I find most troubling is, when we talk about right speech, you know, I think Thich Nhat Hanh says it's supposed to be helpful, it's supposed to be timely, it's supposed to be kind, and it's supposed to be true. You know, so when we look at things, just people believe sometimes that when they speak the truth, or they're being authentic, or whatever they're going to call it, that they have the right to say what they want to say. And that's where I get all gooped up.
Yeah.
What gives them the right to do that?
Right. So I had a chance to study with him, and he did not say, he said three things. Is it kind? Is it necessary? And is it useful? He did not say it was true. And so somebody asked him that, and he said, that is not for somebody like me. I'll just say, it's not, that's not a skillful place for me to go. Because for a lot of my life, I thought everything I said was true. And then based on some trauma and other things that went on in my life, I thought nothing I said was true. And so it's that matter of relative or absolute truth, my truth, your truth, the media's truth, the data says, all that, you know, as human beings, we're going to engage in all that, and that's a fact. And we have to try and find a balance between at what point is that useful and skillful, and at what point is that not. But I think his when he teaches about engaged Buddhism, he said, you know, is it kind? Is it necessary? And you know, and so I think those are the guidelines, because we can all do that. Because no matter, you know, if somebody's making a point at a dinner table that we're at with a group of six friends, and we start to think about, I'm going to correct that for you as soon as you're done talking. At that moment, we've actually stopped listening, because the explanation may come in the next two paragraphs. But by then, I'm already up on my soapbox, ready for you to stop talking, so I can I can fix your messed up perception of the world. And if instead of worrying about what you were saying, you know, I worried about how we were all communicating and engaging with that information. I've quoted this before, so a lot of you have heard it, but it's, I think it's worth quoting. Dr. Maya Angelou said, they may forget what you said, And they may even forget what you did, but they will never forget how you made them feel. And so that's the, I think, the same thing that Thich Nhat Hanh was teaching when he said, you know, do you need to say this? And are you going to be able to say it in a way that's kind and loving? Thanks. Anybody else? Well, then I think it's time to go drink something cold. So thank you, everyone.